This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
And welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer. There was a really intriguing article recently in the New York Times. Its headline was, "Sick of feeling like a tourist? There's a tour for that." I have the author on the line. His name is Jonathan Zwickel. Hey, Jonathan, thank you so much for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
Thanks for having me, Pauline. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So tell me how you got the idea for this article.
The idea came from an experience I had in Athens this past summer, where I had a quick sort of three-night layover, basically, in between some other travel that I was doing. And because it was such a quick stop, I didn't do any research into Athens other than the information that I already had from, you know, history class in high school, and maybe a little bit in college and that sort of thing. And, you know, maybe bits and pieces of news and, you know, sort of updating on the sort of financial situation and just other like sort of travails that that country has been going through that have made national or international news over the past decade or so, but really no details whatsoever. And when I got to the neighborhood that I was staying in and exited the metro, I was kind of taken aback at the degree of, I mean, I can't think of any other word than wreckage that I was immediately surrounded by. I was staying in a neighborhood called Petrolona. And I was just sort of shocked at the ruins that I was surrounded by. And I don't mean like Acropolis style 2000-year-old ruins. I mean like construction from the 70s or from the turn of the last century that was crumbling in total disarray with you know, graffitied slogans, like not mural art necessarily, or, you know, sort of more artistic style of graffiti, but slogans that were mostly anti-fascist or soccer team, you know, football team slogans, and also plenty of like tourist go home type mottos written in Greek, which I, you know, had to photograph and then try to translate. And I was just, I was not prepared for, I guess, just like the sort of urban decay that was so apparent to me. And within this massive neighborhood, you know, populous neighborhood that I was staying in, just seemed like that was kind of the common visual theme that I was surrounded by. And, you know, I spent the day wandering around and taking this all in and speaking with a couple Athenians, you know, just strangers that I bumped into at the bar or in the park and that sort of thing, who seemed very frustrated by the state of their city, their country, their government, their status on the sort of international stage. And all of this was like really illuminating to me, or surprising to me. And I, in the brief time that I had in Athens, I tried to figure out, okay, how can I figure out the story here? What's going on here? And I was Googling around for different walking tours, you know, 90% of which are Acropolis walking tours.
Sure.
You know? Or maybe there's, you know, Greek street food or Athenian street food tours, or there are some history tours that, you know, explore different neighborhoods and that sort of thing. But there was nothing, there's only one experience that I was actually looking on Airbnb experiences specifically. And there was one that described itself as, the tour was called Awful Athens.
Awful. A-W-F-U-L. Oh, wow.
And I was interested in that right away. That one wasn't available. I ended up signing up for a similar tour with the same tour guide. And this one was called the Athens Social and Political Walking Tour. And the catchphrase on the website or on Airbnb was, how did the cradle of democracy become the basket case of Europe?
Oof, yeah.
Which was exactly the question running through my mind. So I signed up for this tour without really any, you know, sort of prior knowledge of the tour guide or the subject matter. And the next day I took the tour, you know, met at the designated spot, and then proceeded to wander through several different neighborhoods within the core of downtown Athens with this guide, mid-30s, very opinionated, super talkative, very well-versed political scientist who was actually born and raised in Valencia, Spain, but had been living in Athens for over a decade. He did some graduate study work in Athens and then ended up staying because he found this place to be such a rich sort of classroom for the kind of, you know, anthropology and political science that he's interested in. And so he then led, you know, this tour that I was on with maybe four or five other folks with the perspective of, and I found this to be really interesting, somebody who lives and is like committed to living in the city, but also somebody who isn't from the city and is an academic and has that sort of more objective distance. So he was clearly like intimate and kind of in love with Athens, but also had a little bit more of a clinical understanding of the politics and sort of the social ills that had befallen the city in the last, like really he kept the history confined within 150 years or so, which, you know, in like American terms, that's like a lot of history. In Greek terms, that's just sort of turning a page backwards, basically. You know, it's just
right,
a blip.
Right.
And, you know, it was just providing so much context into what had occurred since the 1840s when Greece left the Ottoman Empire, which had, you know, had it had been under Ottoman rule for 400 or 500 years before that, and then basically began its process of joining the rest of Europe. And, you know, his point was that at that time in the 1840s, there were something like 4,000 or 5,000 people living in Athens. Today, there are 4 million. So like within that span, you know, the population, just the size of the city has grown immensely without any of the infrastructure to properly keep up, or like without the oversight when it came to construction during some of these immigration booms that led to these really sort of poorly built neighborhoods and roads and, you know, all of the sort of wreckage that I was seeing, you know, as a result of this sort of rapid expansion. And, you know, we went through a couple different neighborhoods that I probably would not have either thought of going to or considered safe to go to had I like sort of stumbled into them. And, you know, at no point was he, I never felt like he was exploiting any of the people that were maybe living on the margins that we were seeing. He wasn't talking about individuals. He was talking about systems and systemic problems and policy problems. And it felt, it was so illuminating to me to hear this perspective after, and, you know, and he was really good at answering questions. You know, he's full of information, a very opinionated guy. And, you know, it became clear that he was offering a sort of counter narrative and perhaps an extreme counter narrative to the more popular, this is Athens, you know, tourism bureau kind of guidebook version of Athens.
Yeah, don't say that. You're talking to the guidebook queen, but
yeah, that's fair.
We try to be as open, and it's interesting because, I mean, you said he did this without being exploitive. And that was going to be a question of mine, because I remember maybe a decade ago, people started doing tours of the favelas of Rio, and it was dubbed poorism, P-O-O-R-ism. Mm-hmm. And there was, it was controversial because people thought, is it okay to go and look at people who are struggling, to gawk basically as tourists? Is that an ethical thing to do? It sounds like this was ethical, though.
It felt that way to me. And I was super sensitive to that potential tension. You know, once the tour got underway, it didn't really enter my mind necessarily just from reading the description. But once we were walking through like the Bangladeshi immigrant neighborhood, which is probably not a place I would have gone, but it was, you know, but there we were. And there are guys that were like in a doorway that were shelling betel nuts and that, you know, so that they could shoot like things that I had never really seen before. And, you know, Isaac, the guide, was, you know, saying hello and talking with them in Greek and, you know, making sure that he was engaging. It didn't seem, I never felt like we had just sort of parachuted in and we were gawking. It was more of a bit more of an immersive experience. And Isaac, the guide, was being as mindful as possible, I think, about describing the economics and the sort of systemic problems or the systemic reasons for these neighborhoods existing as they do, rather than pointing out any kind of individual problems. And in fact, like after I spoke with him after the tour, he said that he, you know, there are folks that join the tour and they want to see somebody smoking fentanyl in a doorway or whatever, you know, the red light district. And he doesn't want to be the guy that's going to take you there. And that's just not part of what his program. And, you know, after 3 hours of this, like, you know, pulling back the curtain, so to speak, I just felt so kind of raw and fully informed in a way that I don't think I could have been by reading the guidebook or by, you know, just sort of trying to find my own way through the city. I was dumbstruck.
And interestingly, this isn't just in Athens. I mean, you opened up the article to show that these types of tours are being done elsewhere, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So Isaac, the tour guide in Athens, is an entrepreneur, and he is expanding this concept and his company to different cities around the world. I think 9 different cities, including Mexico City and Manila and Sri Lanka.
I think Rio was one of them.
Rio is another one. Yeah. I don't remember all of them, but he's intentionally choosing cities that are kind of politically fraught right now, where I think one could travel to and have a perfectly blissful beach vacation, or if it is more your want to find out a little bit more about the way people there are living and the struggles that they're going through, you could opt for one of these social and political tours.
Right.
And so, yeah, I ended up speaking with his counterpart or guy that he works with in Mexico City, who is a federally credentialed tour guide and had been doing that work for a few years. And he said when he saw Isaac's post, like basically a want ad on LinkedIn for a tour guide who is interested in political science, interested in activism and community building and, you know, the problems behind the city that they live in, he said it never even occurred to him that such a tour could exist, that, you know, from the sort of experience that he had and the training that he had from the Federal Accreditation Bureau, you know, they're rather strict about the information that they are hoping their guides will impart.
Sure.
And so, of course, there's nothing about the, you know, political corruption in Mexico City, the history of activism in Mexico City. And those are things that Gustavo, that guide, is very personally interested in. And so the idea of being able to bring those personal interests and these sort of more charged stories into the guide work that he does was, he was immediately turned on by that idea. And
yeah.
So he's now doing these similar tours in Mexico City. And again, there's those other cities that we mentioned and others. If you visit the Planet Walk website, you can see the full sort of rundown of where they operate.
So it's called Planet Walk.
Planet Wonk, as in wonky.
Wonk. Yeah, it's wonky. Planet
yes.
Wonk.
Yes.
Okay, that's good. And, you know, it is interesting because Mexico City is a place where it's being inundated by tourists right now. It's gotten very, very popular, as have many of the others on the list. And people only go to the same places on this narrow tourist track. And that may be why in Athens you have the tourists go home, you know, notes. They're not spending money at the local mom and pop places. They're not adding to the life of Athens. They're detracting from it by wearing this groove in one part of the city. And
yeah.
So that's something else these tours, I would think, are doing, right?
I think absolutely, yes. And I do think that is, you know, one among many potential antidotes for over-tourism is spreading the load, right? Like sort of distributing the visitors to these cities over a broader area. Because wearing a groove, that's a perfect analogy, because you see people that have a TikTok checklist or whatever it is of the sites that they're supposed to see, the foods that they're supposed to eat, and there's going to be a line at every one of those sites everywhere you go. And so, of course, that creates a burden. And it does, while it burdens those businesses, it also takes business away from others, like you're saying. And if, you know, if we were more intentional in our travels or in our guiding around sending people to less traveled places, then I think we would start alleviating some of that over-tourism burden.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, it's a fascinating article. It's been great speaking with you. Thank you so much for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
It's been my pleasure.
If you listen to this podcast, you know that one of my favorite countries is Japan. So even though we discussed Japan a couple of weeks back, I read the most enlightening, delightful book, and I had to discuss Japan again. The book is called 8 Million Ways to Happiness: Wisdom for Inspiration and Healing from the Heart of Japan. I have the author on the line. She is Hiroko Yoda. Hey, Hiroko, thank you so much for A, writing this book, and B, agreeing to speak with me.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. And then also, thank you so much that, you know, you read my book.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I know that the book is meant to be almost like a book of philosophy, although you do weave it with your own personal story, which brings it to life. But I thought this book would be very helpful for people who are going to Japan and want to just better understand what they see when they're there, the culture and the philosophy of the people who live there.
Yeah, my
it wasn't
book...
meant as a guidebook, but I think it could work.
My book, I think it has so many aspects. It could be, as you said, it could be a guidebook. It could be an educational book to learn about my culture, Japanese culture and tradition. And also, my book is about my personal journey to re-engage with my spiritual traditions after my mother passing. So yeah. It is also like a healing journey myself. And also through my journey, I learned that even though I re-experienced the Japanese spiritual traditions, I learned that there actually are so many things that are not just relevant to Japanese people,
sure,
but also relevant to anybody with any background. And that is precisely why, even though the English is my foreign language, I wrote it in English. And I published a book in America, The Tiny Reparation Books.
I don't think anybody reading this would not know that English wasn't your first language. I mean, it reads incredibly fluently. You laugh.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So let's start with the title. Why is it 8 million ways to happiness? That's a very specific number.
Yes. Well, there's a concept called Yaoyorozu no Kami. And Kami means spiritual beings in English. So Yaoyorozu no Kami means 8 million spiritual beings. And the 8 million here, it's not exact number. It simply means many or infinite number. In times of old, the Japanese people thought that everything surrounding them has spirits. The sun, the moon, clouds, river, ocean, I mean, everything. But also, there are kami of plague, kami of poverty, there is kami of even toothache. So that doesn't mean that they venerated those bad things, but they recognize that they exist. No matter how much they, you know, they wish they did, you know, those bad things don't exist, they are there. All the kami, the spiritual beings, are equal in existence. It reminds us, you know, even though you feel bad or good, it's there, so we can deal with it. That idea is still pretty much active today. So the reasons and why, I called 8 million ways to happiness, is because, you know, if there is an infinite number of spirits out there, there is an infinite number of ways to find the spiritual path to happiness. And through my journey, I found my own path. I call it a spiritual toolbox from what I learned. Everyone has a different challenges. And then I believe that everyone can find their own way through them.
Right.
And that's the idea.
Huh. But let me say at this point, you didn't write this book to proselytize or to convert people to the Japanese way of looking at religion.
No, absolutely.
In fact, you start with the fact that the Japanese don't consider themselves religious at all. which came as a shock to me because when I've been in Japan, all you see are shrine after temple after shrine. And so I was there under the assumption that this was a deeply religious people, but maybe that assumption comes from the fact that I come from the West. So I see ties to religions very differently than the Japanese do. Can you talk a little bit about the Japanese relationship to the several religions that exist in Japan?
Yes. Japanese spirituality coexists with a modern society in a different way from religion does in America. Spirituality to us are not a dogma. And from my experience, you know, in America, the faith is a big commitment. But for Japanese, we don't see that way. We actually freely switching from one tradition to the other without any commitment. So yeah, it's interesting that you came to Japan and then they talk about, you know, they tell me that the shrines and temples, there are three times more temples and shrines than convenience store.
Wow.
And you know how ubiquitous the convenience store are.
So, oh, yeah.
And in many of them, many of the temples and the shrines are open to public. Anyone can go in. Visitors are left to themselves. And so long as they act in a respectful manner. So it's a dividing lines. Dividing line in spirituality is very blurred in Japan.
Right. Because when Buddhism came in, that came in on top of Shintoism, which already existed in Japan, but one didn't wipe out the other. A lot of people consider themselves, you say, Shinto at birth, Christian at marriage,
yes.
And Buddhist at death. And we can go into that later, but it's a very distinct mindset. You can believe and not believe. Like you go into a whole chapter about how just for fun often you will go and have your fortune told at a temple. And yet you don't really believe that this is going to be definitive about what your future holds. So it's a kind of a looser or a more dancing, more graceful tie to traditions and religions. Is that fair to say?
Yes. It's basically, simply put, radically inclusive. It's interesting that you call it Shintoism, the Shintoist. I'd like to talk about that.
Oh, please. Yes. So, you know, I'm not sure all of our listeners, in fact, mm-hmm. I'm not sure I understood what Shintoism was before reading your book.
There's a reason why we call, or it's called Shinto. It's in English, it's the way of kami. So it's the way. So that means it's lifestyle. So it's a worldview. So at the very beginning, I explained the concept of Yaoyorozu no kami, 8 million spiritual beings.
Right.
That is, you know, that term is from Shinto, but it's actually much bigger than that. It's our worldview and it's a foundation of the Japanese culture. So if people ask me if I am a Shintoist, I would say no. And instead, I would say I'm Japanese. But having said that, I have to admit that a situation like this, that my answer, I'm Japanese, it's not enough. That's how I feel. It doesn't capture the Japanese spirituality, including Shinto, the way of kami, can provide, because it's a worldview.
Yes. And you start out the book by talking very movingly about the death of your mother she died at a relatively young age, and going out and taking walks and communing with the kami was what helped you get through that very dark period. How specifically did that Shinto worldview help you?
Okay, so the very beginning, or I didn't recognize even Shinto or kami or anything like that, the very beginning. I was just dark period. So I started walking my neighborhood park, and I couldn't do anything. I just walked down, then and just came back and cried. It was just every day I did that. Gradually, I started looking forward instead of looking down, and I started looking up. And then because I was all by myself, I started paying attention to what's happening surrounding me. So, you know, there was insects walking on the ground. It was autumn, so that, every day the color changes from the trees. And then sometimes it's bright blue sky. And so I realized just like, wow, I'm not alone. Actually, I belong to something big, much, much bigger thing, which is nature. And the kami are avatars. Kami belongs to nature and the heart. And that realization was the beginning of my healing process. You know, and then I started re-questioning myself, especially with the spiritual traditions, because shrines and temples are everywhere. I always go just you know, to check them out and pray or be balanced myself. Or my parents' death. Well, then I just go there and have a quiet time. But why am I doing this? Nobody taught me. And that was the beginning. And then I started defining, okay, what kami are. What are they? Or what Shinto's to me, to the vast majority of people? Or what's the Buddhism? What's the Shugendo? There are three major belief systems: Shinto, Buddhism, and Shugendo.
So let's say you're in Japan. Mm-hmm. What do people take away from a shrine or from a temple? What are the parts of it physically that so people who go to Japan can understand better what those spaces are supposed to mean?
The most iconic figure construction is a gate, the Shinto gate. We call it Shinto Torii gate. It has two pillars and two bars atop. There are minor variations, but in the shape, the Sam Torii gates are bright red colors. Sam Torii gates are made of stone, but the shape is basically pretty much the same. So if you find Torii gate and then you are standing in front of the Shinto shrine sacred area. But the thing is, like I said before, in my country, Japanese spiritualities, the dividing lines are very blurred. So you often find that Shinto shrine right next to Buddhist temple, or Shinto shrine inside of the Buddhist temple, the property of Buddhist temple. So in Japan, the Shinto kami and then the Buddhist deities reside side by side, peacefully.
Right. And then there's something called Shugendo, which is a mountain religion. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes. Yes. See, once again, it's very difficult for me to say religion. Buddhism is a religion. Shugendo, it's just like Shinto. It's the way. The way of, literally means the way of gaining power. I mean, it sounds kind of a, crazy, but basically.
Way of gaining power?
Power, yes. Okay. But the power to yourself, to inner journey, it's more spiritual things. The Shugendo is a hybrid of Shinto, Buddhism, and other belief systems. And then centering on the mountains, venerating mountains. Shugendo gives, in my understanding, and that is my interpretation as a layperson, the Shugendo gives a perspective that there might be a spiritual realm out there, but that place, it might be closer than you think, and using mountains as a metaphor, and that's Shugendo.
So how will the visitor come into contact with Shugendo, or will they? Or does it really just tell them about how the Japanese feel about their mountains? And it's a very mountainous country because it's a country that's had a lot of earthquakes and a lot of pushing mm-hmm. up of huge rocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Japan is actually 75% of Japanese land is mountains. Yeah, so mountains are everywhere. And so you can interact with Shigendo practitioners because they are temples, Shigendo temples. So, you know, you can probably ask and then the questions, you know, then probably they will be happily answer.
Before I let you go, I want you to tell us the story of Masakado. Because it was such a fascinating story, and I think it will make people's visits to Tokyo richer. Who was Masakado, and why was it such bad luck to disturb the mound of Masakado?
Okay, Masakado's actual name is Taira no Masakado. Masakado from Taira clan. He is an actual person, historical person. He was a charismatic warrior. He lived in the 10th century. He organized people and fought against the emperor, but he lost. And he got executed at the riverbank in Kyoto. And that's the story. But what is interesting about him is that the legend after he passed away. Okay. Yeah, so he was decapitated in Kyoto, but his head was pretty much alive. And then one day, he swore himself, I would fight again. I would come back. His head flew away, and it landed to the ground, which is Tokyo today.
Right. It flew over Japan to a fishing
from
village.
From Kyoto to Tokyo. Okay.
Right, but it was Edo in that time, right?
Yes. Yes. So not even Edo. It's just it's just the middle of nowhere, and then they're in Edo, and then in Tokyo. So we're talking about it really 1,000 years ago.
Right, right.
So people built the grave for it, for the Masakado, and then that's the Masakado's the mound.
So his head is under the mound, just
yes,
the head.
Yes,
because yes. That's all that flew.
Yes, yes. And the thing is that area is a prime land. I mean, it's the center of Tokyo. The imperial palace is a couple blocks away. So authorities and tried to move that place several times. But for some reason, there's been accidents. And then people decided to leave it as is.
Right. Well, the accidents are fascinating. You know, the man who decides to move it, he ends up dead in a week. And then the Americans come in after World War II.
Yes,
they
GSQ. Want to
build a parking lot and an earthquake. No, and everybody else dies. And then when they try to build the subway line,
yes.
Earthquakes happen.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, lots of accidents.
Yes. The reasons why the people, including myself, love Masakado and then also venerate as a spiritual being, just because there's a concept called Hangambiki. It's a sympathy for tragic heroes. And we Japanese tend to love the passionate underdogs. And then Masakado is one of them. So even though he lost, but here to us, you know, it's like, wow, he tried. And then he made all the best of the best. And then we respect that.
Yeah. So you call it in the book, you say the nobility of failure.
Yes.
Which is a beautiful phrase.
Yes. Because everybody can associate that.
Sure.
You know, you have a goal and then, you know, it's like, and then you try really hard, you know, but even if you don't make it, but still the experience you have or that the, you know, the courage you had means something.
Right.
So, so
can people still see the mound today?
Yes, I do too. And then, so the mound is located in the center of Tokyo in Marunouchi. It's really close to the Tokyo station, and it's surrounded by giant buildings. I mean, the skyscrapers, and it's a shrine. It's like a shrine, and a lot of people go there quietly and then show respect and pray, and including myself. It's fascinating character.
Yes, love I love that story. Yes. Yes, absolutely. The flying head, you know, it's put on a spike and it says, to hell with you. And it takes off.
Yeah. Dave, another reason I'd like to say about the Masakado is that it's a how to deal with anger. And the sense of anger is everybody's, you know, everybody's subject too. I realize anger is hard to deal with, but it's part of us. It's part of the emotions. And so Masakado is kind of, I think it's a symbol of that anger doesn't disappear. It just exists, but it's part of you. So it comes out, but you face it, you can tame it. Right. You take it, accept it, venerate it, it doesn't matter, but you can tame it. That is my takeaway from Max Masakado Mound.
Yeah.
And then that's why time to time I go visit and then show my respect and show this gratitude to teach me my life lesson. I do that. So so as you can probably tell that the Japanese spirituality isn't really about the Japan thing. It is about the cultivating positivity in your life, expressing the gratitude for whatever you're thankful for.
Right.
Or nourishing the sense of belongingness to the bigger system, which is nature. And that thing is not, it's something that I can share to anyone. And that is why I wrote a book in English.
Well, we are grateful that you did. Thank you so, so much for this conversation and the wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
Watching cable, well, it feels so far away. All the channels seem the same. Trying to remember all the songs we like to play, 'cause those lazy afternoons don't come so frequently these days. Oh, it's been so long, and I cannot help but wonder, are you ever coming home? I like you with your sour candy in the boathouse on the lake. Oh, but I hate the way it takes.
Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I, I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single topic, coffee break episodes.
See you there.
Hi, I'm David Brody, co-host of the Travel in 10 podcast. Together, myself and my co-host Tim Johnson have traveled to over 150 countries around the world and all seven continents. Now we're sharing our favorite places, some of our best tips and experiences from all around the world in just 10 minutes on Travel in 10. Join us at voyescape.com.